The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Case Studies of Acid-Base Disorders is presented by Dr. John Pryor.
All right. Without further ado, we're going to talk about everybody's favorite topic, acid-base, right? It's kind of uniformly, people run in the other direction when they see it. All right, so hopefully I'm going to show you a pretty simple way to approach it. Just like we did with glomerulonephritis, you ask a couple questions and you have some answers. So we're going to start out with a case. A 40-year-old gentleman presents to our emergency room with coma. You can see he's acidotic. He's got a potassium of 6.4, he's got a bicarbonate of 5, his anion gap is quite high, BUN is 18, serum osmolarity is high, that's measured, despite the fact that his alcohol level is zero. Mark and I talked, and we could probably report a case of an alcohol level of zero in Scranton. The albumin is normal, his fundoscopic exam shows optic neuritis. How would you approach the differential diagnosis of this acid-base disorder? So going through it, he's acidotic, it's metabolic, he's got adequate compensation, his anion gap is quite high at 30, it's actually 33, not 23. His change in his gap equal to change in bicarbonate, yes, and does he have an osmolar gap? So when you have a gap in metabolic acidosis, you want to know about the osmolar gap, because some of the things that cause high anion gap acidosis also increase osmolarity because they are small molecular substances. One of the ones is antifreeze, right? The reason that so first off, the way they measure serum osmolarity is they look at the temperature it takes to freeze blood. So the higher the osmolarity, the lower the temperature it is to require to freeze blood, just like when you put antifreeze into your car, that decreases the freezing temperature. So that's why antifreeze works, okay? So they check osmolarity by checking freezing point depression. And so in this person, they have some small molecular weight substance that's highly hyperosmolar, and in addition to the fact it causes an anion gap acidosis. So when there's a high osmolar gap as well as a high anion gap, there's really only three things that you have to worry about, one of which is the hospital-based thing. So polypropylene glycol is something that is a diluent in some drugs. The most common one is Ativan. It usually only occurs when you have people on really, really high dose Ativan drips, which we don't do much anymore. The other two are ethylene glycol and polypropylene glycol intoxication. So if you have a high osmolar gap and a high anion gap, and if the osmolar gap's more than 20, this is going to be ethylene glycol or methanol. You don't need levels. You already have a diagnosis. So methanol causes formate. So it's really not the substance itself, but the metabolism of the substance that by alcohol dehydrogenase that causes problems. So methanol is metabolized by alcohol dehydrogenase to formic acid, and it causes CNS and optic toxicity. All you have to drink is half an ounce. Okay, so it doesn't take much to do this. Ethylene glycol causes glycolic and oxalic acidosis, and it usually causes acute kidney injury and CNS toxicity. And they have these nice needle-shaped crystals on urinalysis. And the lethal dose is 1 to 1.5 mLs per kilogram. Again, not much, right? It doesn't take a whole lot of drinking this for them to be intoxicated where they could actually die from this. The good news is the treatment is the same. So whether it's methanol or whether it's ethylene glycol, the treatment is to stop metabolism and get rid of the substance. So the old way we used to stop the metabolism is we would give them ethanol because that would saturate alcohol dehydrogenase, but none of us really have ethanol anymore. At least we don't have it on formula anymore. And instead we use the thing called famiprazole, and famiprazole is an irreversible inhibitor of alcohol dehydrogenase. And when you do that, then you stop the production of the noxious substances, and then you have to dialyze them to take off the actual either ethylene glycol or methanol. Again, polypropylene glycol is the ICU inpatient disease. It's not an outpatient disease. So if they present you a case of somebody coming through the emergency room, it's not going to be polypropylene glycol. All right. So alcohol dehydrogenase, as you can see, and the same is true for ethylene glycol. Famiprazole hits this, and this causes you to decrease the production of these toxic metabolites. And just a quick refresher, alcohol is a small molecular weight substance, right? So if you suspect this disease, you really have to get a blood alcohol level. Because the blood alcohol, if their alcohol level is 300, then it's going to increase their osmolar gap. It will not cause acidosis, but it will increase their osmolar gap. If you take isopropyl alcohol, that'll increase your osmolar gap, but it won't cause metabolic acidosis either. So these are high anion gap acidosis with high osmolar gap acidosis. And these are those beautiful little crystals. All right. So what if you don't? What if we didn't have a high osmolar gap? What is the differential diagnosis? Well, it could be, we all learn mud piles and all these other things. Mud piles doesn't really work anymore because a lot of the initials don't stand for anything that we even use anymore. But anyway, so I prefer to think of this as high osmolar gap and normal osmolar gap. And the normal osmolar gaps are uremia. In that case, your GFR has to be less than 15. Salicylates, which often comes in with a predominant respiratory alkalosis, and it causes lactic acidosis. Lactic acidosis, which sometimes it's pretty simple to diagnose, sometimes not so simple to diagnose. And then the thing called pyroglutamic acidosis, which if you work in a hospital, you've seen this before. You just haven't recognized it. So ketoacidosis is pretty easy. There's diabetic ketoacidosis, and their sugar is always more than 200, except how many people here have seen SGLT2 DKA? Was their sugar high? No. So it's normal glycemic diabetic ketoacidosis. So the drugs that we actually really like to treat diabetes with because they have great cardiovascular and renal outcomes, they can actually cause diabetic ketoacidosis. And it's the same etiology. It's the imbalance between glucagon and insulin, which gives them ketosis. But they usually come in with normal glycemia and diabetic ketoacidosis. So it's actually kind of cool. Then alcoholic ketoacidosis is they have to be abstinent. So this doesn't happen when you're actively drinking, and then finally starvation. As always, beta-hydroxybutyric acid is the predominant ketone body. Diabetic ketoacidosis in the days of yore would at least be acetone positive because their acetone levels were high enough to detect. We don't do acetone levels anymore. No hospitals do acetone levels anymore. So it's really the correct clinical scenario that makes the diagnosis. So how do we treat this? Well, I'll be honest with you. There's a lot of controversy about treating organic acidosis. I think of it this way. You haven't lost bicarbonate in this situation. It's just a different thing. It's beta-hydroxybutyric acid. It's pyroglutamic acid. It's lactic acid. So it's still there. It's just been changed to a different thing. And interestingly, if you improve the pH in these people that have metabolic acidosis, what they do is they make more of the substance because the enzymes are pH dependent. So any trial that's ever looked at the use of sodium bicarbonate for organic acidosis will show you that there's really no benefit, despite the fact there's been thousands of trials that have done for it, okay? So it's very controversial. So we reserve it for people that are really sick. So your pH is less than 7.1, you're in shock, you have refractory arrhythmia. So in this case, the presence of a high anion gap and high osmolar gap acidosis led us to the diagnosis of ethylene glycol or methanol. The treatment, thank God, is the same. We sent off the levels, we treated the patient. 2 weeks later, we got levels back and it was positive for methanol. Okay, recent reports. So the pyroglutamic acidosis, so I want to just give you the case scenario because I would imagine you're going to see this. So you see people that come in and they have this high gap acidosis and you send off a lactate and the lactate is normal. And you say, they must be septic, this must be sepsis. We'll admit them to the ICU, there must be something going on. And oftentimes what they'll do is they'll give you a history. It's usually a woman. Usually they've had some type of gastrointestinal or viral illness at home. They might have taken a fair amount of Tylenol when they come in, And what they have is this thing called pyroglutamic acidosis. And what happens is you develop glycine deficiency because of glutathione deficiency from acetaminophen. And they develop, because of this, you shift the metabolism to make this thing called pyroglutamic acidosis. So we see people with high GAPs, the lactate is normal, oftentimes in the setting of them taking a lot of acetaminophen. And you sort of scratch your head and say, I don't know what the hell this is. And what this is pyroglutamic acidosis. The good news is just treat it by basically withdrawal from acetaminophen and just give them fluids, and they usually will typically resolve within a day or so. Polypropylene glycol, I've never seen in the ICU because we don't use as much Ativan as we used to. I can remember giving 55-gallon drums of Ativan intravenously to treat alcohol withdrawal syndrome. We don't do that much anymore. But that's what, so polypropylene glycol, if you remember what Ativan's like, is so damn thick. What dissolves the Ativan is polypropylene glycol. So if you give lots of it, you can get intoxication. We've seen propofol infusion syndrome, especially when we have people that we have to give high doses, so more than 4 mg/kg/hour. So we typically limit our propofol dosing at 150 milligrams an hour. And with that, we usually don't see the syndrome, but it's usually dose and duration, so high dose for more than 48 hours. And it's typically a lactic acidosis. And diethylene glycol, you'll read reports in the news about Chinese companies that have made certain baby formulas or whatever, and people are dying of this acute acidosis, and it's because they substitute diethylene glycol for glycerol. We can also see drug-induced lactic acidosis, some of them more common than others. So linezolid, we certainly see it with. Metformin, we still see a case or two a year of metformin-induced lactic acidosis. We don't see it as much with HIV medicines because we don't use those drugs as much. The last case I saw was a crazy case of a 90-year-old guy who was demented. And his basic form of perseveration was, I was short of breath, I'm short of breath, I'm short of breath. So he literally was getting beta agonists every hour because the order was written, you can have it as frequently as necessary because they wanted to relieve symptoms. And he had this lactic acidosis that people say he must be septic, he must do multiple cultures, all kinds of things. As soon as we stopped the beta agonists, it went away. So beta agonists in high doses can cause it. And then there's this weird thing that they'll sometimes present to you on board. So it's a person who's got some type of small intestinal problem. So maybe they have short gut, maybe they have gastric bypass, maybe they have bacterial overgrowth. And what they do is they eat a big carbohydrate meal and they get severely encephalopathic. They get brought into the hospital, they get placed on IV fluids, they have a high gapped acidosis, and they send a lactate off and the lactate is negative. The lactate is negative because it's not the usual L-lactate. It's not levolactate, it's dextrolactate. So the lactate assay is going to be negative. And they get all better, they go home to do it again. And people keep scratching their head and say, what's going on? What happens is that these bacteria actually make D-lactate, and they do so in response to a high carbohydrate load. Okay, so that's the high gap metabolic acidosis. All right, next one we're going to do is the hyperchloremic metabolic acidosis. And Mark is sort of giving you some preview of this. So this is an elderly man. He presents with tachypnea, diarrhea, and weakness. And you can see, again, he's acidotic. His potassium is a little bit high. You guys ought to know the diagnosis of this. His bicarbonate is 10. His urine pH is 5. His urine sodium is 40. Urine K is 20. Urine chloride is 50. And how do you approach the differential diagnosis of this? So in high-gapped acidosis, we look at osmolar gap, right? So we have two categories, high osmolar, normal osmolar gap. Here, we look at this thing called urine ammonium. So if we go through the case, he's acidotic, it's metabolic, compensation is appropriate. I made up those numbers, so it should be appropriate. His anion gap is normal. His change in gap is, he doesn't really have one. We don't do an osmolar gap on this kind of person. So you have to understand about how the kidney deals with acidosis, okay? So the kidney has resorption of bicarbonate, that's the proximal tubule, and then it regenerates bicarbonate. So that's the distal tubule. To regenerate bicarbonate, it's got to make ammonium, NH4. And I know Mark spoke disparaging about urine electrolytes and a urine anion gap, but it's actually a very useful way to approach these disorders, okay? So in people that have normal distal renal function, you're going to have ammonium in the urine because that's what you want to do. You want to regenerate bicarbonate. So you would expect that the urine sodium plus potassium should be less than the chloride because there's ammonium there, right? So if the sodium plus potassium equal to or less than the chloride, that means there's no ammonium in the urine. So really what you're looking at is you want to see, is there ammonium excretion or not? So hyperchloremic acidosis is the first question you ask is, what's the urine ion gap? Are they making ammonium? If they're making ammonium, then that's usually a proximal RTA or that's diarrhea. If they're not making ammonium, that could be CKD. That could be distal renal defects, type 1 RTA or a type 4 RTA. So this is the these are the people that have, I'm sorry. I don't know how I did that. Anyway, so these are the people that have normal, these are people making ammonium. The chloride's greater than the sodium plus potassium, so that's somebody who's got severe diarrhea. And so what does the kidney respond to? The kidney tries to regenerate bicarbonate. It gets lots of ammonium in the urine. Or you can have a proximal RTA, which sometimes when it's presented to you, they come in with some phosphaturia and they're hypouric or uric, and they have a proximal RTA with an anion gap that's normal. And there's also drugs that happen, and we see it. What we see it is in tenofovir, I see it in topiramate. So these are two drugs that actually are carbonic anhydrase inhibitors. So they're like giving Diamox. When you give Diamox, you make a proximal RTI. Okay, what if they have an abnormal urine anion gap, so they don't have any ammonium? The chloride is equal to or less than the sodium plus potassium. So that's the classic distal. That's people that can't acidify their urine. They can't make ammonium. We see that with hyperparathyroidism. We don't use a whole lot of amphotericin B anymore. We certainly see it with Sjogren's syndrome. And then there's the type 4 RTA, which is the hyperkalemic distal. So that's the aldosterone segment of the tubule that doesn't work anymore. And it can be because you don't have aldo, or it can be because you're resistant to the effects of aldo. And then people that have GFRs less than 30 start to develop metabolic acidosis. And they do this because they don't make NH3 to make NH4. Okay, so if you have a GFR less than 30, it's CKD until proven otherwise. So this just shows you that as your GFR worsens, you make less and less ammonium. Okay, so in this case, they had a hyperchloremic metabolic acidosis. So the next question we say is, do they have ammonium in their urine? And in this case, no. So it must be a distal defect. The urine pH was 5, so acidification is intact. They were hyperkalemic, so likely this is a type 4 RTA, all right? So this is the case that Mark has shown you twice before. So this is the third time you see this. This by far and away is the most common type of RTA that we see. So it's worthwhile learning this. And we induce this all the time, right? We put people on ACE inhibitors. We give them non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. We give them spironolactone and eplerenone. We put them on amiloride, we make them dry. We do this all the time, okay? We make people hyperkalemic from that segment. If this segment doesn't work, then that's a type 4 RTA. So this is sort of how you approach it. So the proximal RTAs, which is type 2, they can acidify the urine quite well, and they can make ammonium quite well, and then you're done with it. Distal RTA, the classic distal, they can acidify their urine, but they also can't make ammonium. And then that classic type 4, which is they can acidify the urine. They can certainly acidify the urine, but they can't make ammonium, and their potassium's almost always high. If they're going to give you one, it's probably going to be a type 4. And again, you've heard that 3 times so far. This is just brain exercise. So what is this? This is arterial versus venous pHs. So this is people that did a study that they sent blood gases and they sent venous blood gases at the same time, and they plotted them. And lo and behold, look at that. It's a straight line. It's almost 1. They sent arterial and venous CO2s at the same time, and lo and behold, it's a straight line. They even calculated bicarbonate, and it's a straight line. So here's what happens. So if you do an arterial or a venous blood gas, you're going to basically get the same number. How close? Well, for the pH, it's going to be the difference is going to be 0.027. So the difference between 737 and 74. So is that a difference in, are you going to make a different diagnosis from 74 to 737? No. And the PCO2 difference is 3.8. So this is the difference between, say, a PCO2 of 40 and 44. You're going to make a different diagnosis by that. So the question is, why do we use arterial blood gases anymore? Why? Why do we stick arteries to get this? So the results are exactly the same. Now, we will give you one caveat. The one caveat is that people that have low cardiac output, read that as people that have cardiogenic shock, or read that as people that they are rested and you're doing CPR on them, there's a big splay between venous and arterial. It's the only time there's a big splay. But otherwise, there's never a big splay. So I don't order arterial blood gases anymore, or venous blood gases, and that's it. Why would I want to stick arteries if I can get the same answer? Okay. Next thing is that, why do we treat metabolic acidosis? I said we don't really treat the high anion gap, but we do treat people that have lost bicarbonate, and those are people that are the hyperchloremic. First, the reason is this is people that have kidney disease, and if you look at the intervention versus control, this is what happens to your kidney over time if you take sodium bicarbonate and if you don't. So this is one of the few things I can do to my patients to slow progression of disease, and it's as simple as giving them baking soda. So giving them baking soda will let their kidneys last longer. And then these are just nutritional things. So their nutritional status and their appetite and their sense of well-being are much better when you give people sodium bicarbonate. So if you have CKD patients and their bicarbonate is 20 or less, they should be on supplementation. It's simple, it's cheap. Okay, final case. So this is a normotensive ice skater. So when they say ice skaters, they say nurse, they say wrestler. They're asking you about eating disorders, right? They're asking you about eating disorders. So they're giving you clues to say that this is an eating disorder. So this is, I don't know, I can't even tell you. So the good news is I can't tell you whether this is a man or a woman. But as I know, as they present, they're normotensive, they present with alkalosis, and it looks like it's a metabolic alkalosis plus hypokalemia. And initially they got a urine chloride of 50, and then they repeated it one day later and it was less than 20. So how would you approach the differential diagnosis of this? So again, this is a simple question. So you have a metabolic alkalosis. Your question is, what is the urine chloride? So if they have, you have to know that almost all metabolic alkalosis follow the same pathway. One, you have to lose hydrogen and chloride. And where do you lose it from? Well, you could lose it from the kidney or you could lose it from the gut. And if you lose it from the gut, it's usually from the pylorus upward, okay? So typically you get this gastric alkalosis, or you can lose it from the kidney, and that's a metabolic alkalosis. So when you give a loop diuretic to somebody and they become alkalotic, it's because they've lost hydrogen and chloride from that. And then the second part of this is the generation part. I mean, the maintenance part. So once you've generated this, then you have to be able to maintain this, because otherwise you just excrete the bicarbonate. So the way you maintain this is you're dry, you have hyperaldosteronism, and you're hypokalemic. They all maintain the metabolic alkalosis. So people that are chloride responsive, those people have a urine chloride less than 20. Those people, all I have to do is give them potassium chloride or sodium chloride, and they get better. We restore volume, you shut off aldosterone, you fix the potassium, they get better. But the other group of people, you can give all the sodium and potassium chloride and they'll never shut up. So their aldosterone is autonomous. So in this case, one of the times the aldosterone is dependent on volume status. The second case, it's autonomous. It's being made for other reasons other than volume. So what happens with chloride-responsive alkalosis, when you give sodium chloride and potassium chloride, they get better. It shuts off the aldosterone. So it's pretty easy to treat. And that's diuretic-induced alkalosis. That's chloridorrhea. That's a rare disease that we occasionally see. Those are people have PCO2s of 60 and you intubate them and make them 40. Suddenly they have an alkalosis. That's called post-hypercapnic alkalosis. I have no idea what I did. Gastric alkalosis is when you drain hydrogen and chloride from an NG tube. Milk alkali is when you give extra bicarbonate. And cystic fibrosis is chloride loss from the skin. So is there a way to fix that? Excuse me? Excuse me. Do we have AV here? Somehow, we have to get rid of that menu or it won't advance. Okay, maybe now. Somebody did. Okay. Mark told you a little bit about milk alkali syndrome. I don't think we need to do much more about that. And then the other group are the chloride unresponsive alkalosis, and they're all disorders of aldosterone one way or the other. Do you make too much aldosterone because you have a tumor making too much aldosterone? Do you look like you're taking aldosterone, like Little syndrome? Do you look like you're taking loop diuretics, like things like Bartter syndrome? Do you look like you're taking a thiazide diuretic? Looks like you're Gittleman syndrome. So these are all things that I can't shut off I can't shut off aldosterone by giving sodium chloride and potassium chloride. So in this case, this patient, he'd have a metabolic alkalosis with high urine chloride initially, and then when we watched them, the next day their urine chloride dropped down. And so this person had a chloride-responsive alkalosis, of which one of those is diuretics. So the reason the urine chloride was high was they were taking diuretics to lose weight. So this was their eating disorder. So remember, the eating disorders are you vomit, which causes a chloride-responsive alkalosis, you take diuretics, which causes a chloride-responsive alkalosis, or you take cathartics. And cathartics cause diarrhea, which causes bicarbonate wasting, which causes a hyperchloremic metabolic acidosis, right? So if they present somebody to you and it looks like an eating disorder, look at the bicarb. If the bicarb is low, it's cathartics. If the bicarb is high, it's either vomiting or diuretics. And typically diuretics, when they show you the first time, they'll have high urine chlorides because that's how diuretics work.